Buonasera e benvenuti a tutti a questo nuovo incontro di Biennale Tecnologia. Ho il piacere di introdurre il professor Richard Baldwin, che è un professore di economia internazionale al Graduate Institute di Ginevra, fondatore e redattore capo del portale di policy voxeu.org, cioè voxeu.org. Diciamo che il suo lavoro e la sua ricerca diciamo, fornisce a governi e organizzazioni internazionali attività di consulenza su questioni relative alla globalizzazione e alle politiche commerciali. Nella sua, diciamo, nel suo percorso professionale è stato anche Senior Staff Economist per il Council of Economic Advisor del presidente USA George Bush e diciamo che il suo lavoro di ricerca e di studio diciamo, si applica appunto al tema della globalizzazione, che è un lavoro diciamo, che il professor Baldwin compie da ormai da 30 anni. E la cosa interessante, anche la cosa secondo me molto, molto interessante e di grande valore per quanto riguarda diciamo, il suo contributo in questo festival, per questa edizione di Biennale Tecnologia, è che proprio pochi giorni fa è stato pubblicato per il Molino un libro, il suo ultimo libro, che appunto si intitola La rivoluzione globotica, globalizzazione robotica e futuro del lavoro, edito dal Molino, ma che diciamo porta a compimento una riflessione che il professor Baldwin ha diciamo portato avanti nel corso degli anni con altri libri su come diciamo il percorso diciamo di sviluppo economico neoliberista fondamentalmente su scala globale si possa e si sia sviluppato e quali possono essere le ricadute da qui ai prossimi diciamo ai prossimi anni. In questo periodo di pandemia, diciamo, uno dei temi che torna spesso anche nell'agenda mediatica dei media è che, diciamo, la pandemia, il Covid, diciamo, l'emergenza sanitaria che stiamo vivendo ha accelerato dei processi, di innovazione potenzialmente ancora inespressi, ma che vengono accelerati appunto da questa situazione di crisi. Uno di questi processi ha sicuramente a che fare con gli equilibri economico e sociali, capiamo, siamo tutti ben consapevoli delle difficoltà e delle ricadute economiche e poi sociali che diciamo, questa crisi sanitaria ha avuto e ha negli equilibri diciamo, di tutte le nazioni. E il professor diciamo, Baldwin con questo libro insomma, in qualche modo ha colto la palla al balzo, nel senso che io non anticiperò i temi del suo keynote speech, ma fondamentalmente se la globalizzazione 3.0 era diciamo, focalizzata sulla, diciamo, sulla distribuzione a livello globale delle idee dei processi produttivi, adesso ci troviamo di fronte a una globalizzazione 4.0 che probabilmente vedrà il mondo dei servizi, il mondo, diciamo, lo smart working e diciamo, il telelavoro, aprire nuove possibilità, economiche e quindi anche mettere in crisi quelli che sono probabilmente dei sistemi economici e sociali, come quelli dei paesi, dei paesi europei o nord o occidentali, che sono molto basati su servizi che potrebbero entrare in crisi appunto proprio grazie, diciamo, all'accelerazione che certi processi di smart working e di telelavoro hanno subito grazie appunto al lockdown, alla situazione che appunto stiamo vivendo di, diciamo, di lavoro a distanza. Io non voglio anticipare diciamo, i contenuti del keynote speech del professor Baldwin, che ringrazio ed è già collegato. Vi invito a inviare delle domande che insomma, avremo il piacere di sottoporre all'attenzione del professore al termine del suo keynote speech, che potete appunto mandare attraverso la piattaforma di Biennale Tecnologia. Welcome, Professor Baldwin. Thank you for being here with us today at Biennale Tecnologia. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfect.
Okay, I just made a really short introduction of your work and your last books, The Globotic Revolution. And so the state our virtual stage is yours. So we will meet at the end of your keynote speech with some Q&A section with all the questions from our audience. So thank you for being with us, and the stage is yours.
Thank you very much. Well, first, let me say it's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate being able to explain some of my ideas in the book that, as you mentioned, was just published by Il Molino in Italian. In English, it was published early last year in 2019. So let me just get started right away if I can share my screen. Okay, so the title of the book in English, anyway, is The Globotics Upheaval: Globalization, Robotics, and the Future of Work. And I'd like to start with this little infographic, which kind of summarizes the main points that I want to get across in the book, or at least the points that I think are frequently missed. So it starts with this big gray digital arrow. And in my mind, the force of digital technology, the rapid pace in which it's progressing, is changing many, many things. But when it comes to the future of work, it's launching two other arrows. One is automation, and the other is globalization. And the key point here is that it's launching both automation and globalization at the same time, whereas previous technological breakthroughs first tended to launch automation, and then a decade or more later, it launched globalization, a new type of globalization. The second thing that's really different about this one, apart from the fact that automation and globalization are coming at the same time, is that they're affecting white-collar and professional jobs, not just factory jobs, as had been the case in the previous globalization. Moreover, I think it's coming faster than most think and in ways you expect. So this is the basic idea. The globotics upheaval. Globotics is globalization and robotics at the same time, and it may cause an upheaval because it's affecting white-collar and professional workers who aren't really ready for globalization and automation. So let me explain that all a little bit more. And before I start, I want to put out this slide right away. The future is unknowable, but also inevitable. To be sure that you understand, that I understand, that what I'm talking about in the future is something that I can't know. Nobody can know. But in my view, economists have an obligation to use their special skills, their knowledge, their wisdom, to think about the future. Because whether we think about it or not, whether we think it through or not, it's coming. And the absolute worst way to think about the future is to pretend it's just going to be like today. So that's why, even though it's unknowable, it's inevitable, therefore we have to think about it. And so that's what I'm going to be doing in this talk, thinking about the future. Let me start with a couple definitions. Globotics, a word that I made up, it smashes together globalization and robotics. And in this talk and in the book, mostly when I talk about globalization, I'm going to be talking about telemigration. And I'll define that a little bit more clearly. But I'd like to have you think about that as RI, where RI stands for remote intelligence. And I'm going to be talking about robotics, but here in this context, I'm going to be talking about white-collar robots. And you can think of it as AI or artificial intelligence. Now, white-collar robots, I'll discuss both of these in a little bit more detail. So, what is telemigration? Telemigration is people sitting in one nation and working in offices in another. And before COVID and the great lockdown, I had to spend a lot more time telling people about how people can work remotely and how that might spread internationally. But I think all of us now are absolutely familiar with the idea of working from home by digital means. Telemigration is just working from home when home is abroad. Now, a couple of things I'd like to point out about telemigration is it happens at a low end and also at the high end. This is not like globalization in the manufacturing sector, where most people who are affected by it are workers in factories, for example. Here, this on the left, you have a clip from, I mean, I'm not going to show the clip, but it's a photo from a clip The Economist magazine did, which shows how workers all around the world are making some money online, for instance, uploading data. And that is one type of telemigrant. In other words, people who have very low wages who take over relatively routine things that are now done in offices in rich countries. And over here, if you look at Adrian McDermott, that's a higher end guy. So he's involved in software maintenance, software system maintenances, and they hire people all over the world to work in other people's office, essentially being IT support for companies online. So this company that he has, Zendesk, hires talented people in low-cost countries, like, say, the Philippines, in order to provide these IT services in rich countries for much less than it would if you had to hire local people. So this globalization, this competition from foreign workers is happening both at a relatively low end and at a very high end. Now, this is what I mean by white-collar robot. It's basically software that automates service tasks. Now, it also comes at a low end and a high end. Let me start about with the low end. So one of the most common white-collar robots at the low end is called robotic process automation, or RPA. And it's a relatively new thing that's coming very, very fast and taking over a number of routine information management jobs in service sectors, in offices all over, especially the rich countries. For example, one of the companies that does it is called Blue Prism, and it's essentially a way of automating processes. It's like a macro, but it applies to existing systems. And what it's doing is replacing relatively low-end office workers. This is a white-collar robot at the high end, and the robot has with it, associated with it, an avatar, which is called Amelia, who you're looking at right here. But other types of white-collar robots are high-end. There's like IBM has Watson, Bank of America has Rachel. Many of them have, there are many different types of these, and these automate a much higher level job. So for example, they might be helping write financial reports, or they might be doing discovery in a legal case, or they might be looking for fraud in the trucking department or helping to organize logistics. It's basically a very sophisticated AI package, which is trained to do certain things, but also has kind of interface so you can talk to it, it can talk to you, it'll produce output, written output, can read emails and things like that. So these two white collar robots are automating lots of jobs, and they're progressing, and the range of tasks that they can do are advancing, and it's being implemented in companies relatively quickly. So just as industrial robots displace lots of factory workers in the last, say, two decades, these white-collar robots are displacing white-collar workers in offices now. So now what I'd like to do is argue that this time is different. If you think about it, you might be very skeptical that anything really is actually new, because after all, digital technology is just not that dissimilar to information and communication technology, ICT, which we've been talking about for 25 years or more. So when I was doing the research for this book, I convinced myself that this time really was different. And I want to show you over the next few slides a little bits of intellectual infrastructure that I constructed for myself that I want to share with you that convinced me that this time is different. So the first thing I want to point out is that this globalization and automation is affecting service and professional jobs, not just factory jobs. So if you look at the top of this, the top photo, you'll see a bunch of people in service and professional jobs who by and large are unfamiliar with global competition, wage competition, because they have jobs in offices in rich countries, in big cities usually, and they do not view themselves as competing with service sectors abroad because many services are sort of face-to-face. Now, obviously, some services, especially some types of financial services already have been globalized. But for most people in most offices in most rich countries, they've never really had any wage competition from abroad. Now, that's quite different than the people down at the bottom. These people have been competing with China abroad and robots at home for a couple decades. And in fact, by now, there aren't that many left. There'll be something like 80 or 90% in a typical G7 country like Italy will be working with these kinds of jobs, and only about 10% working with factory jobs. So just a point, why does it matter that they're office and professional workers? Well, they're different. First of all, there's lots of them, as I pointed out, something like 80 to 90% of the workforce, and that they're easier to reemploy, but it sometimes involves downgrade unemployment. So for example, journalists in London, you know, if you go back 10, 15 years ago, most of the journalists in London had good jobs with fixed contracts with newspapers, and the digital transformation of media meant that most of them were laid off. Now, many of them are still in London and still doing things like journalism, the writing and editing. Some of them have reinvented themselves for moderating TV shows or doing blogs or whatever. But many of them have gone into what you might call downgrade unemployment. That is, although they still have a job and they're still working, and indeed they may be making the same amount, the work is precarious. And so this uncertainty makes the jobs that they have now as kind of freelancers putting together different things is a downgrade of the job they had before. And so even if they're making the same or even if they're making more, they may not be that happy about it. They don't have an easy time to plan vacations, for example, or to take sick leave or to have a pension plan. Those things that used to come with jobs they no longer have. But most of all is these people are not ready for the globotics that's coming, the globalization and the robotics. Now, here I'd like to point out that some very important developments have come up since I published my book. COVID, of course, is the big one. Now, four things. Lots of people are already fired. So the fixed cost of firing somebody has already paid. So when you're trying to hire back, you have a different trade-off between hiring a software robot or offshoring the task or firing somebody since they're already fired. The second is COVID forced an emergency digital transformation that will be lasting and massive. And the more people that get online, the easier it will be to offshore some of those tasks abroad. So basically all of our companies, our managers, our workers, our customers, they've all become used to dealing with digital teams online. Now, our companies and institutions may soon realize that since everybody's online working remotely, they could get some of those remote services for 1/10 the price by offshoring it to a country where €5 an hour provides a middle-class income. The third is that social distancing raises a relative cost of in-person workers and white-collar workers versus telemigrants. In other words, if you were on the edge of automating or offshoring a particular service sector job, the fact that social distancing makes office space more expensive may lead you to take the automation or the globalization solution. Now, that's not massive, and it won't last forever, but social distancing probably will be part of our lives for at least another year, and certainly during a good part of the rising return to economic activity when companies will be deciding, should I hire back workers or should I automate them away? And last, of course, is that firms are under extreme cost pressure because of COVID. A lot of them have had to borrow, and so they'll have a big need to lower costs by potentially offshoring or outsourcing or automating. Okay, so Digitech is ICT, but the difference is ICT was applied to manufacturing, which was mostly physical, and it had a little bit of I and a little bit of C. In other words, it had a little bit of information and a little bit of communication, but mostly the ICT was about physical things. Digitech is applied to services, and this is mostly information and communication and only a little bit of physical. Now that matters because a different physics applies. The physics for automating manufacturing is the physics of matter. The physics that applies when you're automating services is mostly electrons. Now, one thing that's important to point out is that things change much more slowly when you're trying to change physical things, things that involve matter, than when you change electronics. Just to make that concrete, for example, if you look at the amount of time it took to double the flows of imports and exports of goods, the answer is 2 decades. If you want to know how long it takes to double the flows of information across borders, the answer is 2 years. And the reason that's possible is because the physics that constraining changes in manufacturing, mining, and farming don't really apply to services, or not in the same way. So this thing is coming much faster because it's applying to services, not manufacturing. Number three, AI, today's AI is different. So in 2019, computers can read, write, see, speak, understand speech, create visual output, recognize subtle patterns. In 2015, they couldn't, or at least not very well. So what changed? My answer is that the programming is different. So before 2016, 2015, programming was mostly done by coding. In other words, you set out a logical set of statements which go through a problem and tell the computer what to do in every single possible situation. Now, the point about that is, in order to program the computer, you actually have to know how we're doing what we're doing. So if you want a computer, for instance, to reproduce something that a human is doing, you have to know how the human's doing. Now, that brings us over here to this book, Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. Many of you will have heard of it. It was written by Daniel Kahneman, who got the Nobel Prize. And coding is really thinking slow. Thinking slow is conscious and effortful, and we know we're doing it. What we're doing nowadays with machine learning, which is the new way of programming, is more like thinking fast. In other words, when you think fast, it's instinctive, it's unconscious. You don't know you're doing it, and frequently you can do several things at the same time. You can walk up the stairs while you're reading, for example. And we don't even know how we do that. Now, the reason we can program computers is because we use machine learning to develop the programs, or actually it's estimating models. So you get a great big structured data set. By that, we mean the question is clear and the answer is clear. And if you get a large amount of data where you have the question and features and then the outcome, you can estimate an enormous non-statistical model to make guesses on other inputs. So the thing is that these models are so complex and so nonlinear that not even the AI geniuses that are estimating them know exactly how, for example, the computer recognizes a cat is a cat. That's just exactly like us when we think fast. It's unconscious and effortless. Now, the whole point of this analogy is that computers, since about 2016, have acquired a whole set of cognitive skills that they never had before. They can see, read, write, speak, things like that. And some of those skills are useful in the office. And it has opened the door to automating a whole set of service sector tasks that couldn't be automated before, doing programming the old way. Okay, the robotics is advancing at an explosive pace. Past transformations were much slower. Now, what I want to do here is explain that using an analogy. So here we have three photos. The photo on the left is the Apollo 11. That was the first time a man landed on the moon in 1968. Was an amazing thing. The Apollo 11 mission was guided to the moon and back by one of the largest supercomputers on Earth at the time. Took up an entire room. And it was amazing that this spacecraft could leave the Earth, get to the moon, land, and come back, and nobody died. It was an amazing thing. Now, in the middle here, we have an iPhone 6S, which is also a supercomputer, significantly smaller, but way, way more powerful than the mainframe computer that guided Apollo 11 to the moon and back. In particular, the iPhone 6S is 120 million times faster than the mainframe computer that guided Apollo 11 to the moon and back in 1969. That's amazing. 120 million times faster. But you want to know what's even more amazing is here on the right, we have an iPhone 10. Now, that came out in 2017 when the iPhone 6S came out in 2015. Now, the iPhone 10 is 2.5 times faster in terms of processing speed than the iPhone 6S. And if you think about that, that means that there was more progress in processing speed between 2015 and 2017 than there was between 1969 and 2015. And since the iPhone 10, there's been the iPhone 11 and now the iPhone 12, each time doubling. So the point is that each doubling leads to increments of processing power that are absolutely unfathomable and leading to all sorts of possibilities, making things quite normal, which before were hardly even envisionable. Now, one of the points I'd stressed before is that this automation and globalization is happening together. And during past transformations, automation started long before globalization, and that gave us time to adjust. So for example, in the first transformation, which was really started with steam power started being used in industry in about 1720 to pump water out of mines. And then it started progressively leading to mechanization of manufacturing, especially in England. And then when steam power got small enough to put on boats and rails, it opened up globalization. And from about 1820 on, we got a massive explosion of globalization. This time, they're happening at the same time. And let's say when ICT came out in 1973, for example, that's when computer on a chip was invented, and then they put chips on robotic arms, and that's when the automation of manufacturing really got going. But the modern globalization from ICT point of view really started in 1990, which was two decades later. This time, they're both happening together. The sixth point is that it's coming faster than most believe. I think this is a bit of a puzzle. It must be some sort of bias. It was predictable, but unexpected. We even have a name for it. They call it digital disruption, and it happens again and again and again. Now, I've kind of come up with this little diagram to explain why people, I think, keep getting surprised by exponential growth. So here's what I'm going to assert. On the vertical axis is progress, on the horizontal axis is years. And I'm just going to assert that humans think instinctively about progress. I mean, think about with thinking fast. Instinctively, you look at how much changed between today and yesterday or last year, and you kind of assume that what's going to happen tomorrow or next year is proportional to the increment you had before. And so if you're thinking that the increments in the future will be like the increments in the past, you're straight lining the future. But that's not how digital technology actually progresses. Digital technology starts as an exponential curve like this. And once it gets high enough, it hits some diminishing returns and it flattens off into a kind of lazy S curve or logistics curve. Now, the point is that in the beginning, it looks like this exponential growth is way slower than linear growth. Then it shoots up and then it levels off. And where those cross is what I like to call the holy cow moment. When people knew things were changing, they just didn't expect them to change so fast. It's because when they saw this slow growth from a low base, they said, well, it's a change, not very much. But the increments kept getting twice as large each period, and as a consequence, that eventually increments were absolutely enormous and overwhelmed the linear growth, and people were surprised. Okay, now what I want to do is argue that this globotics upheaval, the integration of globalization and automation into our service sector, is coming in ways that few expect, and I'm going to go through this relatively quickly. So first of all, think tasks, not occupations. The point here is that many jobs will go, but few occupations. And the analogy I'd like you to use is how tractors and farmers are related. So tractors changed the job of farmers, and it meant that we needed fewer farmers to grow the same amount of food. But tractors did not replace farmers. So it was not the occupation of farming that was replaced, just the number of farmers came down. And in the same way, I don't think robots are going to completely eliminate many occupations, but I think they will change every occupation. They already are changing almost all service sector occupations. And it may lead to a lower headcount, at least in many occupations. Second is it won't look like a factory closure. And I think this is one of the major misthinkings of the future globalization that's being made. As people look back to see what happened with globalization in the last two decades when it was affecting manufacturing sector and think it's going to be that going forward. But the point is it won't look like a factory closure because these globots are not shutting down entire factories or entire floors of office buildings. It's more like downgrade unemployment, not mass unemployment, Rust Belt style. People are transiting from one type of service job to another type of service job pushed out by globots, but they are finding other jobs, even if they are more precarious. This is how I'd like you to think about how globotics will transform the future of work. I'd like you to think about it as the iPhone infiltration. So think about how iPhones came into our lives. If you go back just 10 years ago, iPhones didn't do very much, and they weren't a very important part of our lives. But after one incremental innovation after another, and one new app after another, the smartphones have become an integral part of our lives. They've changed our societies. They've changed how we interact as families. They've changed how we interact with our bosses. They've even changed how we interact with our physical environment in cities. Now, the point is that nobody planned this to happen. And for many years, people didn't even know it was happening. And I think that was because each and every little use, each task you now took over with your smartphone seemed very small. And they all seemed unconnected with each other. But when you put them all together, it was really an upheaval in how we live. And as a consequence, that's how I think robots will come into our offices. One task at a time will be either offshore or automated. It won't look like a revolution, but if we look back in 5 years or 10 years, we'll say, how could we ever get along without them? Okay, now job displacement is the business model. Now, this is really a question of speed. Digitech is driving job displacement. Human ingenuity is driving job creation. And so the problem is not the displacement of jobs, it's the mismatch of the speed. So just in this kind of little infographic, let's say that job displacement is driven by digital technology, so it goes up very quickly at first and eventually levels off. But job replacement is driven at the linear process of human ingenuity. So in the first part, displacement outweighs replacement, and there's a sort of a pressure on the job market. But eventually, we get all the jobs we want. So that's how I think about it. Some people think we're going to stay here forever, the pessimists. Some people think we're going to jump to the place where we have jobs. I'm a pessimist to begin with in the short and medium run, and an optimist in the long run. Okay. So now let me just get to the future globalization of telemigration, and I'm going to do this quickly because I want to leave plenty of time for question and answers. So telemigration, wage gaps are making it profitable. Digitech is making it possible. So for jobs like my job, I'm an economics professor, like many of you will be. Turns out a Swiss economics professor makes about 20 times what a professor of economics makes in Manila, in the Philippines. And that wage gap could drive my institute to potentially replace some of the things I do with lower cost professors from abroad and therefore need fewer people like me. And Digitech is making it possible. And as we've all realized, it is possible to teach remotely. And the fact that I'm in Switzerland, that helps a little bit. But if it was 20 times, if it was 1/20th of the price to get somebody else to do it, I suspect universities are going to start to replace some lecturers or at least some aspects of our jobs with overseas workers. And that will go through everything, high-end workers, low-end workers. So just to point out the big factors for telemic. First of all, domestic telecommuting. This is in essence the thin edge of the wedge. It's kind of opening up to international telecommuting, and COVID has accelerated that enormously. These online freelancing platforms, Upwork, which is the largest one, these are like eBay or Alibaba, but for services. In other words, you post a job and somebody, a worker's online, and you match for freelancing. Upwork rose 40% in one day because the potential for this kind of telemigration, or at least that's what I believed, potential for this telemigration is growing so fast because of the digital changes of COVID. Advanced telecoms, I don't have to tell you all about that. We're all used to more advanced telecoms than we were before. And machine translation. I won't go into this, but it's a big deal. Machine translation is getting much better. Used to be a party joke, but if you haven't tried it in the last 6 months, you should try it because it's way better. And in any case, it's everywhere. It's on for free. Google Translate, Skype Translator, YouTube Auto Translation, Microsoft Translator and Outlook. So machine translation is everywhere, and it will open up the road to lots of competition. So I will assert, just conjecture about the future, that there will be a global talent tsunami. So in the 1990s, you could say the joining of countries like China for the world trading system opened up a tsunami of unskilled workers in the manufacturing sector. The 2020s, I think, are going to open up a tsunami of talent in the service sector. Okay, long run of the future of work. The good news is, I believe, new jobs will appear as they always have in the past. So let's think about what these future jobs are. Now, the first thing to say is we can't know their names, just like we didn't know the names of the jobs that people were going to get when they were leaving farms in the 1800s. And going to factories because they were going to work in industries that didn't exist. For example, in 1850, people didn't know they would be making electric fans because there were no electric fans, or pharmaceuticals, or the car industry, for example. And the same thing is when we went from factories to offices in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, and 2000s, we didn't really know the names of the jobs we would get because we ended up doing services that we didn't even know we needed to do. So that's the same thing that's going to happen. Just because we can't think of the names of the jobs doesn't mean they won't appear. But that means we can still guess about what the jobs will be like. And there's where I'd like to go with this line of thought. We should use a process of elimination. And I'm going to assert that globots will do what they can. We will do what globots can't. So the question is, what can't globots do? Now, globots is just the combination of remote intelligence, which is the globalization part, and artificial intelligence, which is the white collar robot part, which I put together to call globots. So first part, what can't AI do? And there's a lot of studies about what types of jobs can be automated by today's AI. There's a very nice McKinsey report that lays it out in great detail. And if you look at that, roughly speaking, the stuff that AI can't do is the most human task. Things like providing empathy or ethics or curiosity or innovation or managing large groups of people, motivating large groups of people. That kind of thing is difficult for AI to do because it's hard to get large structured data sets for it. So whatever the jobs of the future are, they will involve a lot of human tasks because the other tasks will be done by white-collar robots. The next question is, what can't remote intelligence do? Now, these are real humans, so they can do anything we can do, but the only thing they can't do is be in the same room. Now, if you think about that, that means that the jobs of the future will require lots of tasks where you actually have to be in the same room with another person or a machine or a piece of equipment. Now, if you put that together, the long-run future of the work means the jobs will be more human and more local. Excuse me. Now, because of the productivity, we'll be richer, and I'm being an optimist, think we'll be more generous societies if we manage the transition. So that, for me, is the big problem. The long-run future of work is very nice, But because of the displacement outstripping the replacement, at least in the short run, I worry that there will be an upheaval. So I'll end right there, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you very much. This is the back cover of the book, by the way. So I'm back.
Okay. Sorry, I was in mute. So sorry.
No worries.
Okay, thank you for your speech, Professor Baldwin. It has been a great pleasure. I would like to ask you a few questions, and the first, it's really simple. We are Biennale Tecnologia is hosted in Politecnico di Torino, which is one of the main universities in Italy. And my first question is: what would you say to a student who has to enter university, or more generally, to someone who has to think about his training in this framework of globalization 4.0?
Okay, so let me, first of all, I'm not a labor expert, and I didn't really write at great length. There is some discussion in the book of how to prepare for this. I think there are two factors which are absolutely clear. The first is we will have to change jobs a lot more frequently than we did in the past. So flexibility of whatever type will be more important than it was in the past. So whether you're going into a technical subject or you're going into social sciences or humanities, it's important to develop a flexibility, an ability to learn, so that you can redistribute or redeploy your talents in different tasks, because the turnover of jobs is going to be faster than it was before, in part because many service jobs will be changed by software robots that automate many tasks, and many jobs will be offshored, or tasks will be offshored, and so how we use them will be changed. Now, I like to draw an analogy of something we've actually seen, which is the company Snapchat. So Snapchat, it went public, only had about 300 employees, and they were all in the same building. And what they did was use artificial intelligence and freelancers online to develop the product very, very quickly. So they would try things, they could dial up the project very quickly because they could hire freelancers, or they could do it with machine learning or automation solutions. And so those people were, in essence, like a chef d'orchestre, a kind of conductor, conducting offshore workers and conducting technological solutions to come rapidly together. And they were dealing with many types of people: the marketing, the finance, the technical people, regulatory, legal, all those people. So you needed people with lots of flexible skills. So first of all, it's flexible. The second thing is absolutely clear that the hardest skills are the first one to be automated. Coding, for example, or at least low-end coding. That's something that can be done. It's already getting close. That will be done because it's a repetitive thing on which you can gather a large data set. So I think it's important to emphasize soft skills, like being able to work in teams, to be able to manage, to innovate, to perceive subtle patterns, to deal with unknown situations. And so that kind of training is going to be more than before. And if I could just say one summary is, there's been a huge emphasis on STEM and hard skills. And I think while that's always a good idea, and you certainly need a minimum of those, the soft skills are the ones that are going to make your job more proof or resistant to automation and offshoring. So that's how I would say, stay flexible and don't underestimate the soft skills.
Thank you, Professor Baldwin. I have two questions from our audience, and two questions that are a little bit similar. So I will try to put together the two questions. And the first one is, in your opinion, due to this incredible technological advance, is it plausible or possible that in the long term, human work will lose importance because it is largely replaced by machines, and so universal income is established? Or, and the other question is, shouldn't we also think that about the redistribution of wealth to manage the transition? It could be a good idea.
Right. Okay, so let me start with the second one first, if you will. Now, if I would, I brought along a couple of slides for just this question. So this graph shows the percent of GDP, that is the share of income earned by the top 5% earners from 1688 to 2009. This is in the UK. Now, if you go way, way back before the Industrial Revolution, you see the top 5% had 35% of income. And it sort of rose gently during the Industrial Revolution, which may you might say go between 1750 and 1870. And then from the second Industrial Revolution, which started around 1870, you know, where we started getting chemicals and electronics and electric and stuff like that, the inequality fell for about 100 years. Now, in my mind, what the reason that inequality fell was the automation that was going along here gave more power to manpower, manual manpower. It gave more muscles to people who worked with their hands. They had drill presses and things that were mechanized. Advance of mechanization didn't really help people who worked with their heads very much. So it was really a technology that favored manual work, not mental work. And since the manual workers had a lower income than the manual workers, this biased technological progress essentially lowered inequality. Now, once you get to about 1970 or so, when the computer on the chip was invented, the computer on the chip, together with industrial robots, created better substitutes for people who work with their hands. In the mines, in the factories, and on the farms, the ICT was developing things that were better substitutes for humans because routine work could be automated. But at the same time, the technology, the ICT, created better tools for people who work with their heads, things like word processing or spreadsheets or databases, telephones, all these things made the productivity of people who work with their heads higher. Now, that meant that this bias, this skill twist, led to rising inequality between 1970 and about now. Now, what I would point out is that artificial intelligence is not at all like ICT when it comes to inequality. One of the most remarkable things about artificial intelligence is how easy it is to use. You do not need a university degree to do translation now. All you have to do is know how to use Google and you pop the text in. Or if you're on Twitter, you just push the button. So the thing about AI is it's giving more mental power to average people. Of course, it's also increasing the mental power of very talented people, but not relatively as much. So in my mind, I think the AI, the machine learning models, which are essentially data-based experience pattern recognition, will make average workers more productive than they do most talented workers. So just take, for example, in medicine. With a nurse with a really good AI can do a lot of the work of a doctor. And the doctor with the AI, he can do more work as well, but the relative catches up. And the same thing if somebody's doing a draftsman versus an architect. With a really good AI, a draftsman can do more of the work. Or say somebody working on the road, there's an engineer with experience and a degree, but with a really good AI, the road chief on the road can do part of the work of the engineer. So I think AI is going to create a whole class of semi-professional jobs which raise the productivity of the average worker more. So in my mind, artificial intelligence is going to be creating good jobs for average people and helping them because it's boosting mental power of average people more than it's boosting the mental power of the most, or in terms of work anyways, of the most talented. So me, I think the inequality is actually going to go down, at least in the medium or long run. Now, let me stop sharing here. So the point about this whole thing is I think we will need more redistribution in the short run during this upheaval period when job displacement outstrips job replacement. And you start to see it already with COVID. COVID led to a great deal of displacement, and we needed more redistribution in order to keep the society just and fair, if you want to be moral about it, but to prevent riots, if you want to be pragmatic about it. I mean, you need more redistribution. So in the short run, I think we do need more redistribution. Now let me come to UBI, Universal Basic Income. I think Universal Basic Income is an interesting answer to the wrong question. Now the right question is, how am I going to get 10 or 15% more of tax revenue out of GDP? Because that's what you need for universal basic income. Now, once you tell me how we're gonna increase the tax base to raise this much more money, we can have a very interesting discussion of how to spend it. And once that discussion gets done, I don't think just handing it out will be the optimal solution. It may be part of it, maybe some sort of basic, but helping people to retrain, helping people to move, helping people to take care of their kids if, for example, they need to, or whatever is necessary to help people adjust to the technological change. Direct active labor market policy, I think, is something we're going to need more of. So once we get all this extra revenue people are talking about we're going to get, I don't think all of it, spending it on UBI is the right thing. And I think it's a very seductive but misleading discussion to say, should we give everybody $1,000 a year? Well, why not? Sure, that'd be great. But where are we going to get that money? And if we actually got that money, is that the best way to spend it? So I think people forget about the basics of budget constraints when they start talking UBI. Now, I'm not against UBI or anything. I think, like here in Switzerland, what we have is a little bit of form of it. Every parent gets about 400 euros per month per child that's dependent upon you, regardless of your income. And so for people who are doing well, that's, you know, not very important. But for people who are struggling, that those 400 francs euros per month make a big difference. And that's kind of a little bit like universal basic income, although it's tied to kids. And what they say here in Switzerland is what we're trying to do is encourage parenthood or making parenthood easier. And they don't want to spend a lot of time looking at everybody's income and filling out forms and means testing everything. So they just give everybody this, and it's simple, fast, and done. A very, very easy program to implement and fair. So I think there's a lot to be said for some types of things like that. But I think universal basic income doesn't really solve all the problems that people think it will. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
I have one last question, because I think that also thinking about this, your last answer, the welfare state becomes very important in this scenario. And when we talk about welfare state and we talk about European welfare state or US welfare state, we are talking about two different worlds, totally. Right. And so I read an interview, an interview you made some months ago, maybe 1 year ago. You were saying that when the white collars and blue collars call together, what will happen? This is the problem. We have to manage it. How we can manage it? So my question is that regarding Europe, just a few days ago, for the COVID crisis, the European Commissioner for the Economy, Paolo Gentiloni, declared that the European Union should not reactivate the Stability Pact also for 2022. Do you think that the Next Generation EU plan represents a good strategy to respond to challenges of globalization 4.0?
It's a start. I mean, I think it's important that the vast majority of the welfare policies be designed locally, because it's different. Job markets are different. Labor market regulations are different. So I don't think it should be too well crafted at the top. But part of what you said is COVID. But COVID is a truly public thing. And that the costs and benefits, I think, should be shared widely, because COVID in Europe isn't going away until it's gone away everywhere. And the financial fragility of some states would pose further dramatic problems if that's allowed to go boom. So this is a moment for solidarity. So the social welfare states, my basic belief is that there's a lot to be said for having it local. So, you know, subsidiarity sort of thing. People fix their, you know, how do you want to educate the kids? How do you want to deal with relocation? What level of income? Those are things that shouldn't be the same for Denmark and Portugal, I think. And so primarily, I believe in those locally. But I think the national governments have to step up their efforts. Active labor market policy is more important. How much the European Union's involved, I'm not so clear about that. But what I've been very impressed is how well, relatively well, I mean, remember, we hadn't even heard of this disease 10 months ago. We hadn't even heard of it. And Europe has done some major reforms to help out. It showed solidarity that I'm not sure I would have expected to help out. And the ECB has changed the way it acts to help out. So I'm actually very pleased with how the European Union. So you alluded, has reacted to things. You alluded to the United States, and there I really am worried. That's where the upheaval comes from. I'm afraid that they won't be able to slow it down enough, and probably will have to use regulation rather than active labor market policies. So Europe, I'm hopeful. US, I'm worried.
Okay, thank you, Professor Baldwin. I want to quote you, because you said that regarding the fact that in the several studies show that technology will disrupt jobs, but they also argue that almost as many jobs will be created. And you say to this question, I'm pessimistic in the short run, but I'm optimistic in the long run. You say that. So what would you say to a young guy that is listening to us right now, talking about his future and jobs of the future and the future of jobs and works? What would you say to him or to her?
Well, I think they have to be flexible, and the future is work. See, it's not so. The problem isn't so much the young people. It's people who have working on in an insurance company for 10 years, and they think they have a good job, and then they're going to be replaced by white collar robot. The younger generation, they're coming into the market, and many of them are dealing. I don't think it's a good thing, but many of them are dealing with precarity and uncertainty in their new jobs and are more flexible. So I especially going out with COVID now, it's a very bad time to go out, but there's a good time to stick around and do one more degree in university if you can. But the real tragedies, I think, are going to be the things that happen to 50-year-olds in terms of people really getting upset. So for young people, if you really want to make this work for you, these are tools. Artificial intelligence and outsourcing freelancers can make you more productive in what you're doing. You just have to know how to use them and show the flexibility to put them together. So it's like the Snapchat. You know, the young people, they have to go into creating these new jobs and working in them. So, you can see I'm trying to be optimistic, but I do think the second word in my title in English is upheaval, which is kind of now you've turned into revolution. So I do expect a lot of problems, but honestly, I think the young have a lot of problems. This is part of it, but the ones I'm really worried about are the people who are going to have trouble adapting to it, who are a little bit more middle-aged.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor Baldwin. Our time is running out. And so thank you for being with us at Binari Tecnologia. And I remember to our guests, I will talk now in Italian to remember your last, that would be
Aspetti.
So grazie al professor Richard Baldwin per il suo contributo, e ricordo anche il suo ultimo libro, La rivoluzione globotica, globalizzazione robotica e futuro del lavoro, che è stato proprio in questi da Il Mulino. Thank you very much, e buon proseguimento con Binari Tecnologia. Thank you, bye bye, ciao.
Thank you very much, next time in person.
Yeah, of course.